the bulk of the mining profits. Amplified operations led to rampant growth and an influx of impoverished workers from neighboring worlds. Iriadu's once lush mountains were soon stripped of cover. A pall of pollution hung over the major cities, and the standard of living plummeted. Still, there was prosperity for a few. Quick credits to be made in ore processing, local and deep space transport, and usury. For the Tarkans, wealth came by providing security. Their climb to the top had been hard won. Among Iriadu's earliest pioneers, the ancestral Tarkans had had to function as their own police force and defenders, countering attacks first by the ferocious predators that thrived in Iriadu's forests and mountains, then by off-world rogues and scoundrels who preyed on the exposed populations of the struggling settlements. Under Tarkan leadership, local militias evolved slowly into a sector military. As a result, and despite his celebrated ancestors having had their start as hunters, freelance pilots, and mining contractors, Tarkan thought of himself as the product of a military upbringing in which discipline, respect, and obedience were held in the highest regard. Avowed technocrats as well, the family held a view that it was technology, more than Korolag, that had rescued Iriadu from savagery and had allowed Iriaduans to forge a civilization from a murderous wasteland. Technology, in the form of colossal machines, swift starships, and potent weapons, had helped convert the hunted into the hunters. And it would be technology that would one day usher the planet into the elite of the modern galaxy. While Tarkan had been raised with all the advantages that came with wealth, it was a curious kind of privilege. In mansions that strived to emulate the architectural fashions of the core, but were little more than gaudy imitations of the originals, the Tarkans and others like them did their best to mimic the customs of the affluent, without ever succeeding. Their hardscrabble roots were far too apparent, and life on Iriadu seemed barbaric compared with life on cosmopolitan Coruscant. Tarkan understood this at an early age, particularly when dignitaries from the Corps visited and made his parents feel smaller than he knew them to be. Less evolved for living on a wild world whose outlands were racked by seismic quakes, whose rough cities lacked weather control and opera houses, and whose residents were still battling pirates and rapacious nature for supremacy. And yet he felt no need to search outside his own family for childhood heroes, since it was his ancestors who had fought back the wilderness, survived the odds, and brought order and progress to the Seswenna. Even in relaxed and safe surroundings, then, Tarkan was not the entitled child one might have imagined, judging by his tailored clothes or rambling home. As proud as his parents were of their achievements, they were also well aware of their low social standing among people who mattered. They never missed an opportunity to remind their son that life was inequitable, and that only those with an appetite for personal glory could succeed. One needed to be willing to crush underfoot anything or anyone. Discipline and order were the keys, and law was the only unanswerable response to chaos. At every opportunity, Tarkan's parents would emphasize what it meant to live in deprivation. Their sermons were designed to drill into their son the fact that everything they owned was the product of having overcome adversity. Worse, affluence could vanish in an instant. Without constant vigilance and the drive to succeed, everything one had could be wrested away by someone stronger, more disciplined, more committed to personal glory. How do you imagine we came to the point where we have so much? His father might say over dinner. While so many outside the gates of this elegant home have to struggle to survive? Or do you imagine that we have always resided in such luxury, that Iriadu was accommodating from the start? Early on, young Wilhuff would only stare down at his plate of food in silence, or mutter that he had no answers to his father's questions. Then during one supper, his father, tall and straight-backed, with deep forehead creases that curved down past his eyes like parentheses, ordered the family's servant to remove Wilhuff's meal before he'd had a chance to take so much as a bite from it. "You see how easy it is to go from having everything to having nothing?" his father asked. "How would you fare
if we now banished you to the city streets,"
his mother added. Nearly as tall as her husband, she dressed in expensive clothes for every meal and affected elaborate hairstyles that were sometimes hours in the making.
"Would you do what you needed to do to survive? Could you bring yourself to wield a club, a knife, a blaster, if weapons were what it took to keep you from starving?"
In an effort to calculate the expected response, Wilhuff glanced between the two of them and puffed out his chest.
"I would do whatever I had to do."
His father only grinned in disdain.
"A brave one, are you? Well, you'll have that bravery put to the test when you're taken to the Carrion."
The Carrion. There it was again. That strange word he had heard so often growing up. But just then he asked,
"What is the Carrion?"
His father seemed pleased that his son had finally wondered aloud.
"A place that teaches you the meaning of survival."
In the quiet comfort of the family dining room, rich with the heady odors of exotic spices and long-simmered meats, the statement had no meaning.
"Will I be afraid?"
he said, again because he sensed he was meant to ask.
"If you know what's good for you." "Could I die there?"
he said, almost in self-amusement.
"In ways too numerous to count. Would you miss me if I did die?"
He asked them both. His mother was the first to say,
"Of course we would."
"Then why do I have to go there?
Have I done something wrong?"
His father placed his elbows on the table and leaned toward him.
"We need to know if you are simply ordinary, or larger than life."
To the best of his ability, he mulled over the notion of being larger than life.
"Did you have to go there when you were young?"
His father nodded.
"Were you afraid?"
His father sat back into his tall, brocaded armchair, as if in recall.
"In the beginning, I was. Until I learned to overcome fear." "Will I have to kill anything?"
"If you wish to survive." With some excitement, Wilhuff said,
"Will I get to use a blaster?"
His father shook his head in a grave manner.
"Not always. And not when you'll need one most."
Wilhuff grappled with imagining the place, this Carrion.
"Does everyone have to go there?" "Only certain Tarkin males,"
his mother said.
"So Noma never had to go?"
he asked, referring to their diminutive, heavily jowled near-human servant.
"No, he didn't."
"Why not? Are Tarkins different from Nama's family?"
"Who serves whom?" his father responded with force. "Have you ever placed a meal in front of Nama?" "I would."
His mother's expression hardened.
"Not in this house. What you learn on the Carrion will one day allow you to show Nama how to be content with his station,"
his father went on. Wilhuff struggled with the word station.
"To be happy about serving us, you mean?" "Among other things, yes."
Still on unsure ground, Wilhuff fell silent for an even longer moment.
"Will you be taking me there, to the Carrion?"
he asked finally. His father narrowed his eyes when he smiled.
"Not me. Someone else will come for you when the time is right."
A more delicate, impressionable child might have lived in fear of that day, but to Wilhuff the threat of sudden change, the abrupt undermining of his effortless life, and the need to forge his own future eventually became a promise, a parable, an adventure on which he yearned to embark, made real in his imagination long before it actually came to be. The day arrived shortly after his 11th birthday. Wilhuff was, by then, a ship-shaped kid burning with desire for bigger things, already something of a dreamer, an actor, an exaggerator. He was seated with his parents for the evening meal. The litany of harsh reminders was about to commence when three men, looking as if they had just crawled out from beneath a mine collapse, barged through the front door and into the dining room. Tracking mud across the polished stone floors, they began to stuff the pockets of their ragged long coats with food snatched from the dinner table. When Wilhuff looked to his suddenly silent parents, his mother only said,
"They've come for you."
But if his parents and the three intruders thought they had taken him by surprise, he had one of his own in store for them.
"First, I need to get my gear," he said, hurrying up the curving stairway as expressions of puzzlement began to form on the faces of the uninvited guests.
The looks were still in place when he returned a moment later, dressed in cargo pants and a multi-pocketed vest he had stitched together in secret over many weeks. Dangling from his neck was a pair of macro binoculars that had been a birthday gift. His gear, his outfit, his uniform, for when it would be needed. Scanning Tarkin from head to toe, the tallest and grimiest of the three launched a short laugh that shook the anteroom chandelier. Then he stepped forward to take the boy by shoulders that would remain bony and narrow throughout his life, shaking him as he said, "That's a beauty, it is. A uniform fit for a future hero. And you know what? It'll look even better with blood on it." His father stepped forward to say, "Will Huff, meet my father's brother, your grand-uncle Jova." Jova grinned down at him, showing even teeth, whiter than Wilhuff would have expected considering his uncle's dirt-streaked face. "Time to go," Jova announced. So, whisked from his home without a reassuring embrace from either parent, the two of them standing instead in each other's arms, expressions of sad resolve on their faces, this was something he needed to experience. And through the gate into Iriadu's pitch-black pall, safe for the moment within the uniform, exhilaration stifling the hunger he was already feeling. Whisked not only from the manicured grounds, but also from the city itself in an aged airspeeder, on a shaky flight across the finger-shaped bay and up into the hills beyond to follow the meandering Orineswa River to a region he had never known to exist on his home world. One that seemed more the stuff of holodramas and escapist literature. An untamed expanse of flat-topped mesas separated by surging, boulder-strewn rivers, and in the far distance, volcanic mountains that were perhaps still active. Even more shocking was Jova's explanation that while vast areas of Iriadu were much like this one, everything the boy's wide blue eyes could take in from horizon to horizon was family land, Tarkin land, procured 20 generations earlier and never allowed to fall into the hands of developers, miners, or anyone with designs on the region. A protected place and more. A natural monument. A reminder of what the planet could devolve into, should sentient beings lose their grip and surrender their superiority to nature, to savagery. For young Wilhuff, a place of initiation, and central to it all, the Carrion Plateau. A rickety speeder, listing to one side because of a faulty repulsor lift, carried them up onto the tabletop summit. Wilhuff, Jova, two other head-clothed elders, and a pair of elderly Rhodians who worked as guides, caretakers, trackers. All six of them perched atop the ailing machine, and Wilhuff's five keepers carrying long-barreled slug throwers. His hunger partially staved by dried meat almost too tough to swallow, Wilhuff was beginning to have serious misgivings, though he refused to let them be known. This was a much darker and more dangerous place than the one his imagination had conjured. Fixed on masking his unease and on seeing an actual animal in the wild, he sat with the macro binoculars glued to his eyes as the speeder navigated immense stretches of grassland and forest, passing thick bold 10,000-year-old trees with skinny, near-leafless limbs, monolithic ruins and cliffside petroglyphs 10 times older, and shallow seasonal lakes dotted with flamboyant birds. At length, that first twilight, he spotted something, a stately quadruped 2 meters tall, striped in black and white and crowned with graceful curving horns. My first animal in the wild. The others spied it as well, without the aid of magnifying lenses. And Jova brought the speeder to a jarring halt, but not, as it happened, to gaze on the beauty of the beast. In unison, the antique rifles came up and half a dozen shots rang out. Through the glasses, Wilhuff watched the majestic creature leap up, then fall heavily onto its side. and a moment later they were all hurrying through the sharp grass in an effort to reach their kill before other predators or scavengers could arrive, and also to get to it while it was still warm. Wilhuff asked himself what the creature had done to deserve such a fate. If it, too, had come to the carrion to learn the meaning of survival, it had failed miserably. The Rhodians rolled the animal onto its back, and from a sheath strapped to his thigh, Jovar drew a well-used vibroblade.
"Cut straight up from between the legs to the throat," he said,
handing Wilhuff the knife, "and take care not to make a mess of the innards." Fortifying himself, worried as much about fainting as about disappointing his elders, Wilhuff plunged the point of the weapon through the creature's fur and flesh and tasked the vibroblade to cut. Hot maroon blood spurted, striking him full in the face. The Rhodians seemed almost gleeful as it dripped from the tip of his nose to his chin and down the front of his pristine vest, saturating the seams and pockets he had stitched with such care.
"Good cut,"
Jovar said when the carcass had parted, the smell of the beast's entrails nearly overwhelming Wilhuff.
"Now you reach deep in there."
He indicated a place in the torso.
"And follow the rear curve of the breathing muscle until your hands find the liver, then pull it out. Go on. Do it. Do it, I said."
In went his hesitant, shaking hands, maneuvering through squishy, bulbous organs until they found a heavy lump rich with blood. He had to yank several times before the liver broke free of its fibrous net of blood vessels and ligaments, and he nearly fell backward when it did. Then Jovar took the slippery, uncooperative thing into his calloused hands and began tearing chunks from it.
"This one's for you,"
his uncle said, placing the largest of the pieces in the palm of Wilhuff's already blooded hand. He motioned with his chin.
"Go ahead now. Down it goes."
Once more, Wilhuff focused on living up to expectations, and when he had gotten past his revulsion and devoured the chunk, his uncles and the Rhodians celebrated his act with a short song in a language Wilhuff didn't understand. Celebrated Wilhuff's first step, the opening stage in an initiation that wouldn't conclude until years later, at the Carrion Spike. While Iriado didn't have indigenous creatures as large as the Rancor or as unusual as the Sarlacc, it did boast ferocious felines, carnivorous crustaceans, and a species of Viamok far more fierce and cunning than others in its primate family. For the next month, Wilhuff did little more than follow in the tracks of his elders, observing predators of many varieties killing and devouring one another, and learning how to keep himself from being similarly devoured. There was no denying that witnessing death up close was a far more visceral experience than watching such events transpire in holodramas viewed in the airy tranquility of his bedroom. Still, he struggled to understand just what he was supposed to be taking away from the close encounters. Could daily brushes with death transform a simply ordinary person into one who was larger than life? Even if that was possible, how could that transformation have an impact on the lives of Nama and others like him? He might have been able to puzzle out the answers were he less preoccupied day to day with being set upon and eaten by the beasts they stalked. Gradually the routine changed from merely observing kills to stealing them. Frequently the Rhodians would use their vibro-lances to drive killer beasts back from their quarries and hold them at bay while Wilhuff rushed in to complete the theft. Other times it would be Wilhuff's turn to wield a vibro-lance and someone else who would make the grab.
"We are teaching them how to behave in the presence of their betters," Jovar said. "The ones who learn profit from the laws we lay down. The rest die."
He wanted to make certain Wilhuff understood.
"Never try to live decently, boy. Not unless you're willing to open your life to tragedy and sadness. Live like a beast, and no event, no matter how harrowing, will ever be able to move you."
When his uncle decided that Wilhuff had experienced enough stealing, it came time to do the actual hunting. And so Jova and the others began to teach him tactical methods for taking advantage of the wind or the angle of the light. They taught him how to defend against attacks by groups of beasts by confounding them with unexpected moves. They taught him to kill by concentrating all his power on one point. All the while, the vest became more bloodied and tattered, until ultimately it was useless except as a rag, and he was on his own, without a uniform or costume to hide within. The routine of tracking, hunting, killing, and cooking over fire continued as the land surrendered the last of its moisture to the blinding sky. His feet turned raw, and his sunburned skin blistered, his mind given over to memorizing the names of the carrion's every tree, animal, and insect, all of them serving one purpose or another. Late one evening, the speeder's powerful forward lamps illuminated a rodent as it leapt from the sawgrass, and with a carefully aimed collision, Jova sent it flying. Wilhuff was instructed to use his vibroblade to excise a scent gland buried where the animal's thin, hairless tail met its plump body. From that gland, the Rhodians prepared a musky gel that they then used in their hunts for more of the same rodents. Similarly, they prepared stimulant concoctions from residue drained from the stomach of long-necked ruminants or the droppings of felines that had ingested certain plants. Wilhuff grew accustomed to eating every part of an animal, and to drinking blood on its own or mixed with mind-altering plants gathered during treks across the plateau. Over time, he became so inured to the sight, smell, and taste of blood that even his dreams ran red with it. He kept waiting for the adventure to conclude at some log-walled shelter stocked with prepared food and soft beds, but the days grew only more harrowing, and at night, half-starved scavengers would circle and howl at the edge of a meager cook fire, their eyes glowing furiously in the dark, waiting for a chance to rush in and steal back what food they could. The tight-knit band of humans and Rhodians didn't always succeed at remaining at the top of the food chain. Jova's cousin, Zealot, was killed during a nighttime raid by a gang of reptiles whose saliva contained a powerful poison. By mid-season, Wilhuff knew real hunger for the first time and came close to dying of an illness that caused him to shake so violently he thought his bones would break. Sometimes, even the smallest of the plateau's creatures would catch them unprepared and get the better of them. One night, when they had been too exhausted to set up a perimeter of motion detectors, he dreamed that something was feasting on his lower lip. And what his numb fingers found there was a venomous septoid, its pincers anchored in his soft flesh. Waking with a start, he hurried through the open flap of the self-deploying tent, only to land in a stream of the segmented critters, which were all over him in a moment, hungry to find purchase wherever they could. By then, his pained cries had woken the others, who themselves became targets, and shortly all of them were all hopping around in the dark, yanking septoids from themselves or plucking them off one another. When at last they had retreated to safety, it became clear that the assailants comprised only a narrow tributary of the insect river. The principal torrent had gone up and over the tent to where the Rhodians had stored pieces of the beasts the group had slaughtered and dressed earlier in the day, all of it now devoured to the bone. But regardless of whether they had won or lost the day, Wilhuff would be treated to tales of his ancestors' exploits, the lore of the early Tarkans. All of Iriadu was similar to the carrion before humans arrived from the core to tame it, Jova told him. Every day, on their own, as pioneers and settlers, they waged battles with the beasts that ruled the planet. But our ancestors' eventual triumph only altered the balance, not the reality. For all that sentients have achieved with weapons and machines, life remains an ongoing battle for survival, with the strong or the smart at the top of the heap, and the rest kept in check by firepower and laws. Jova explained that the Tarkin family had produced a succession of mentors and guides through the many generations. What made him unique was his decision to make the carrion his home following his initiation in young adulthood. That was how he came to have tutored Wilhuff's father, and why he might even live long enough to tutor Wilhuff's son, should he have one. They spent the remainder of the dry season on the plateau, leaving only when the rains came to that part of Iriadu. Wilhuff was a different person when the speeder carried them down from the mesa and back into civilization. Jova had no need to lecture him on what technology had allowed his ancestors to achieve in the planet's handful of cities, since it was evident everywhere Wilhuff looked. But Jova had something to add. Triumphing over nature means better lives for sentients, but dominance is sustained only by bringing order to chaos and establishing law where none exists. On Iriadu, the goal was always to rid the planet of any creature that hadn't grown to fear us, so that we could rule supreme. Up the well, outside Iriadu's envelope, the goal is the same, but with a different caliber of predators. When you're old enough to be taken there, you're going to find yourself faced with prey who are every bit as quick-thinking, well-armed, and determined to succeed as you are. And unless you've taken the lessons of the Carrion to heart, only the stars themselves will bear witness to your cold, airless death. And they will remain unmoved. Returned to his comfortable bedroom, Wilhuff wrestled with what he had been put through, the experiences on the plateau infiltrating his sleep as vivid dreams and night terrors. But only for a short time. Little by little, the experiences began to shape him, and would become the stuff of his true education. Each of the next 5 summers would find him on the Carrion, and each season his education would widen, right up until the day he had to endure his final test at the Spike. But that was a different story altogether. Chapter 5. Predacity. Tarkin waited until the Carrion Spike was in hyperspace to announce an impromptu inspection of the officers and enlisted ratings who were accompanying him to Coruscant. In the starship's austere main cabin, furnished only with a round conference table and chairs for 6, 18 of his crew were standing smartly in 2 rows, arms at their sides, shoulders squared, chins held high. Each wore a uniform similar to his, though the tunics were slightly longer and the trousers slimmer and more threadbare than those the fabricator had produced for him. The officers wore brimmed caps, studded with identity discs, and displayed code cylinders in their appropriate pockets. Hands clasped behind his back, and looking stylish in his new garments, Tarkin had reached the last crew member in the 2nd row, a midshipman, when he stopped to peer down at the instep of the junior officer's left boot, where a smudge of what looked like grease or some other viscous substance had left a large circular stain. "Ensign, what is that?" he asked, pointing. The young man lowered bloodshot eyes to follow Tarkin's forefinger to the spot. "That, sir, must have spilled some hair product I was applying in preparation for the inspection." His gaze was unsteady when he looked up at Tarkin. "Permission to wipe it off, sir." "Denied," Tarkin said. "To begin with, it's obviously a stain, Ensign, not some blemish you can simply rub out." He paused to scan the midshipman from head to toe. "Remove your cap." The youth's brown hair was regulation length, but it did indeed have the stiff look that hair gel might have imparted. "Attempting to train it, are you?" The midshipman stood stiffly, eyes front. "Exactly, sir. It can be unruly." "No doubt. But that blot on your boot is not hair product." "Sir?" "One can tell, simply by the way it congealed, that it is lubricant. Lubricant of a type used almost exclusively in the repulsor generator of our T-44 land speeders." Tarkin's eyes narrowed as he focused on the stain. "I see, too, that the lubricant is impregnated with grit, which I suspect came from outside Sentinel's auxiliary dome,
almost certainly from where the landing platform is undergoing renovation.
The youth swallowed.
I don't know what to say, sir. I could have sworn.
One of our land speeders was recently sent to the repair bay of the vehicle pool, after having become fouled by construction dust, Tarkin said, as if to himself. There are areas in the bay that are not entirely accessible to our security holocams. However, I often tour the vehicle pool to review repairs, and recently have chanced upon envelopes of a sort that have become fashionable for the storage of a particular class of stimulant spice. His gaze bored into the youth's face. You're sweating, Ensign. Are you certain you're fit for duty?
A touch of hyperspace nausea, sir.
Perhaps. But nausea doesn't account for the fact that the thumb and index finger of your right hand bear yellow ochre stains, which are often the result of pinching plugs of spice that hasn't been sufficiently processed. I observe, too, that your left eye tooth reveals what appears to be a nascent cavity, such as might be caused by dipping spice. Finally, your record indicates that you have recently been late in reporting for duty, as well as inattentive when you deign to report.
Tarkin paused for a moment. Have I forgotten anything?
Embarrassment mottled the midshipman's face. Nothing to say for yourself, Ensign?
Nothing at this time, sir.
I thought not.
Tarkin swung to a female officer standing at the opposite end of the row.
Chief, Ensign Baz is relieved of duty. See to it that he is escorted to the crew berth and confined to quarters for the remainder of the voyage. I will decide his fate once we reach Coruscant.
The petty officer saluted.
Yes, sir.
Also, alert Commander Cassell that the vehicle pool has become a rendezvous area for spice users. Tell him to perform a flash inspection of all barracks and personal lockers. I expect him to confiscate all inebriants and other illicit substances.
Sir,
she said. Dismissed, the rest of the crew scattered with haste, and Tarkin blew out his breath in irritation. The conversation with Mos Amida had left him on edge, and he was taking his frustration out on his crew. He understood and fully supported the idea of a chain of command, but he took it personally when power plays interfered with his duties. He trusted Cassell to attend to Sentinel's responsibilities in his absence, but he wasn't comfortable with being summoned away at such a critical time, much less without full explanation. If the purpose of the visit was to discuss the recent attack, then perhaps he should have delayed filing the report. If not about the attack, what matter could be so vital that it couldn't wait until after the looming shipments were safely escorted to Geonosis? What was done, however, and he was determined to present the best possible face to the Emperor. Leaving the main compartment, he walked forward through two hatches to the ship's command cabin, which he had designed to be more spacious than those found on similar ships, as it was here that he spent most of his travel time. Immediately he found himself relaxing and let out his breath in slow reprieve. If exasperated by Coruscant's demands, he should at least be able to find some solace in the ship. At just under 150 meters in length, the corvette fit neatly between the old judicial cruisers and Corellian Engineering's new generation frigates. Heavily armed with turbolasers, ion cannons, and proton torpedo tubes, and featuring a Class 1 hyperdrive that made it the fastest ship in the Imperial Navy, the Carrion Spike had been designed specifically for him, and to meet many of his personal specifications, by Sinar Fleet Systems. Based on a prototype stealth corvette that had been introduced during the Clone Wars at the Battle of Christophsis to counter Separatist Admiral Trench's blockade of the planet, the triangular-shaped ship was unique in having cloak technology. Powered by rare stygium crystals, the stealth system rendered the ship essentially invisible to ordinary scanners. Hearing Tarkin enter, the captain, a slim, dark-complected man who had served under Tarkin during the war, swiveled in his acceleration chair.
Sir, do you wish to assume the controls?
Tarkin nodded. and replaced him in the command chair, running his hands over the instruments as he settled in. The Carrion Spike's ion turbine sublight arrays, countermeasures suite, and navicomputer were also state-of-the-art, the latter allowing the ship to make the jump from Sentinel Base to Coruscant without exiting hyperspace to retrieve routing data from relay stations or primitive hyperwave beacons. Gazing into the nebulous swirl of hyperspace, he decided that, yes, he could take comfort in having such a ship. In many respects, the Carrion Spike was a sign of just how far he had come and where he now stood in the Imperial hegemony. And what Iriadu wouldn't have given for such a vessel in the decades leading up to the Clone Wars. At that point, the Sector's problems were pirates lured by sudden wealth, privateers hired by Iriadu's competitors in the Lomite trade, and resistance factions protesting the unjust practices of shipping conglomerates operating with impunity in the free trade zones. Iriadu would eventually triumph with the defenses it had at its disposal, but a ship like the Carrion Spike might have granted the Seswenna the edge it needed to vanquish its enemies with greater efficiency and added flourish. In the absence of a Republic military, and as punishment for refusing to provide the core worlds with profitable deals, judicials, the Republic's non-Jedi law enforcers, were often withheld from intervening in disputes, leaving the Seswenna little choice but to create its own armed forces, a loosely knit group that came to be known as the Outland Region's Security Force. The Sector's response to pirates and privateers had to make do with second-rate ships built on Iriadu or at Sluis Van, and with laser and ion cannons purchased from arms merchants who for a century had been ignoring the Republic's ban on the sale of weaponry to member worlds. Not 6 standard months after passing his ultimate test on the Carrion Plateau, 16-year-old Wilhuff was sent up the well to begin his training in space combat, his tutelage supervised by an entirely new cast of characters, some of them Tarkans, but others from worlds as distant as Bothawai and Ryloth. Jova had neither a taste nor the tolerance for space, but would sometimes sedate himself with anti-nausea drugs and accompany his grand-nephew, less to offer hands-on instruction in astrogation, combat maneuvering and weapons training, than to make sure that Wilhuff was applying in zero-G the lessons he had learned on the plateau. "More than 50 Tarkans have lost their lives to marauders," his uncle told him, "and the number of Iriaduans who've been killed is beyond estimation." To drive home the point, their first stop was a colony world of Iriadu that had suffered a recent attack by pirates. Wilhuff had had ample time to grow accustomed to the sight, scent, and taste of blood, but he had never seen so much human blood spilled in one place. The mining colony had been attacked without warning, thoroughly plundered and burned to the ground. Those settlers who hadn't died of laser wounds or been incinerated in the fires had been mercilessly butchered and left to be picked over by scavengers or consumed by insects. It was clear to Wilhuff that many of them had been tortured. Hundreds of settlers had been abducted and perhaps already sold into slavery. Wilhuff was sickened, physically and spiritually, in a way he had never experienced on the Carrion, and the disgust he felt gave rise to despair and a hunger for revenge. "This is the way of things among the Lawless," Jova said as they moved grimly through the destruction, not so much to defuse Wilhuff's outrage as to anchor the massacre in a moral context. "Pirates, privateers, or activists, they are no different from the vermin and predators we dealt with on the Carrion. They need to be educated and acquainted with our notion of law and order. So you treat them just like the ones we hunted or forced into submission, striking fast and in full commitment. You make use of asteroid fields, nebulae, star flares, whatever you find to intensify the havoc. You keep them off balance with unexpected maneuvers, and you let your starfighters function like vibro-lances in the hands of our Rhodians. You establish supremacy like we showed you, by concentrating all the force at your command on one point, hammering away like you would with a vibroblade, through armor like you would through scales or cartilage or bone, and you show no quarter. You stay on your quarry until you've found the soft spot that brings death, and you put the fear into the rest by gutting your victim, ripping out his liver and devouring it. As he was expected to, Wilhuff took his uncle's instructions to heart by demonstrating in space the metal he had shown on the carrion. The incident that would garner the most attention in the academies he would later attend was one involving Iriadu's ore convoys and a Senex sector pirate group, known as Ka'ana's Marauders. Loans from off-world financiers had enabled the Greater Seswena to create the Outland region's security force. But the militia had far too few vessels to protect every Lomite shipment traveling between Iriadu and the core. Making the most of the shortage, several pirate groups had forged an alliance, wherein some would monitor or engage Outland's warships, while others preyed on the unguarded convoys. The titular head of the alliance was a human female known only as Ka'ana, whose audacious raids throughout the Senex sector had made her something of a folk hero. A native of the core world Brental IV, she was the only daughter of a former bodyguard for House Cormund, who had accepted a lucrative offer to leave the core to oversee security for House Elegin on the world Asmeru. Trained in combat by her father and eager for adventure, Ka'ana became the mistress of the youngest son of the noble house, who was himself leading a secret life as a pirate, and whose group Ka'ana eventually joined. Fighting alongside the members of her lover's crew, Ka'ana lived a colorful and bawdy life until the young Elegin was captured, sentenced to death, and executed on Carfedion. Having by then given birth to Elegin triplets, Ka'ana dedicated herself to avenging the death of her paramour by targeting ships and settlements strewn across the Senex-Juvex sectors. At the point she became a nuisance to Iriadu, she had already become the subject of breathtaking holonet tales and scandalous rumors, having survived starship collisions and starfighter crashes, blaster bolt and vibroblade wounds, and countless fistfights and personal duels. Said to be as fast on the draw as a circus sharpshooter and as talented on the dance floor as a double-jointed Twi'lek, Ka'ana had chewed off her own infected hand while awaiting rescue on an isolated moon, and was known to wear artificial arms and at least one leg from the knee down, in addition to an ocular implant and who knew what else. Twice she had been captured and sentenced to lengthy terms in maximum security prisons, and had escaped from each thanks to daring rescues mounted by her soldiers who all but worshipped her. Only her link to House Elegin had saved her from execution, but following an encounter with judicial forces, during which she destroyed 6 ships, the Republic also put a high price on her head, and it was that bounty that had landed her in the Greater Seswena, a sector rarely, if ever, patrolled by judicials, notwithstanding repeated entreaties by Iriadu and other harassed worlds. Lomite convoys typically comprised up to a score of unpiloted container ships, slave-rigged to a crude shepherd vessel, now and then with an armed gunboat trailing. Each container was capable of jumping to hyperspace, but during those years, before the era of affordable and reliable navicomputers, the convoys had to navigate by hyperspace buoys located along the route. And experience had proved that jumping in single file was safer than going to hyperspace in clusters, even though the maneuver left the containers vulnerable to attack on their reversions to real space. Outland capital ships would ride herd on valuable shipments, but ordinary convoys frequently found themselves targeted by Ka'ana's flotilla of deadly frigates and corvettes. With the swiftest ships engaging the shepherd vessel, the rest would deliver boarding parties to some of the containers and separate them from the pack. Once the slave rigs of the ore carriers were disabled, the boxy vessels would be slaved to a dedicated pirate frigate and jumped in line to hyperspace. By the time Outland could respond to the distress calls, Ka'ana's crews were already selling the stolen ore on the black market, or turning it over to the companies that had hired them to carry out the raids. The convoys became easier and easier pickings, and Iriadu Mining began to accept that it was more cost-effective to surrender the containers than to risk having their overpriced lead or follow ships destroyed in defensive engagements. The company attempted to trick the pirates by placing empty container ships among the fully loaded ones, but the dummy ships only prompted an increase in the number of raids. The company also tried concealing explosive devices and even, on a few occasions, parties of armed spacers in some of the containers. Not once, however, did Ka'ana's raiders take the bait, and over time the strategy of including dummy containers and armed troopers was also deemed too expensive. Attempts were made to predict which containers the pirates would target, but in the end, Iriadu Mining's battle analysts decided that Ka'ana was choosing containers at random. Just coming into his own as a lieutenant in Outland's anti-piracy task force, Wilhuff refused to accept the disheartening analysis and devoted himself to a detailed study of the raids in which Ka'ana had participated, failures and successes both, in the hope of deciphering her method for choosing containers. Her attacks weren't at all like the hunts he had witnessed on the Carrion Plateau, where solitary predators or prides would select the stragglers, the young, or the weakest of the herd animals, and for some time it indeed appeared that her choices had neither rhyme nor reason. But Wilhuff remained convinced that a pattern existed, even if Ka'ana herself wasn't consciously aware of having created one. The scheme that ultimately emerged was so deceptively simple, he was surprised no one had unraveled it. Ka'ana turned out not to be the pirate's original name, but rather one she had adopted after her father had relocated the family to Asmeru. In the ancient language of that mountainous world, the word referred to an ages-old festival that always fell on the same day of the planet's complex calendar. The 234th day of the local year, in the 16th month. Ka'ana had assigned each of the five numbers to a letter of her name, and had used that sequence as her basis for choosing targets. Thus, on her initial attack on an Iriadu mining convoy, she had targeted the second container ship counting back from the lead ship, then the third one from that, then the fourth from that one, and so on, until she had grabbed five containers. On subsequent attacks, the sequence might commence substituting the last targeted container for the lead vessel. Sometimes she would reverse the sequence, or move forward in the line rather than toward the rear. Occasionally a pattern would begin in one convoy, but wouldn't conclude until the next convoy, or even the one after that. The numeric sequence itself, however, never changed. Ka'ana was essentially spelling out her sobriquet over and over, as if leaving her mark on every convoy she attacked. Once Wilhuff had grasped the pattern and persuaded Outland's commanders that his months of obsession hadn't driven him completely mad, Iriadu Mining agreed to sacrifice several container ships to the pirates as a means of confirming the theory. Emboldened by the results, the company urged Outland to stock the predicted convoy targets with soldiers, but Wilhuff's paternal cousin, Ranulf Tarkin, proposed an alternative method for exacting revenge by secreting a computer virus in the container's hyperdrive motivators. One of Outland's most respected commanders, Ranulf, who so resembled Wilhuff's father they could have passed for twins, had designed the ploy years earlier, but Iriadu Mining had balked, based on the cost of having to outfit countless containers with the virused computers. With a lead on which containers Ka'ana would target, however, the company agreed to finance the measure, even though the strategy entailed dispatching only one convoy at a time, and often operating at a loss. To make matters worse, the attacks suddenly ceased. It was almost as if the pirates had learned of the ploy, and with increasing pressure from core buyers for added shipments, and wasting funds on attempts to ferret out spies in their midst, Iriadu Mining was on the brink of financial ruin when the marauders finally struck, targeting precisely those containers Wilhuff had predicted. No sooner did the pirates slave the containers to their frigate than the virus wormed its way into the ship's navicomputer, overriding the requested jump coordinates and delivering it to a real space destination where Outland warships were lying in wait. Once the frigate had been crippled and boarded, and Ka'ana and her crew rounded up and shackled, Ranulf, always the gentleman, insisted on introducing the pirate queen to her 18-year-old captor. Her sneering expression ridiculed the very idea of it. "Barely a whisker on his chin, but luck enough for a professional sabacc player." It was your vanity that turned out to be a laudable substitute for luck, Wilhuff told her. You need to leave your signature all over Iriadu's convoys. Her real eye opened wide, and she quirked a grin that told him she understood what he had accomplished, but she followed up the begrudging grin with a snort of contempt.
There isn't a prison that can contain me, boy, even on Iriadu.
Wilhuff offered the sly smile that would later become a kind of signature. You're confusing Iriadu with worlds that have noble houses and trials by jury, Ka'ana. She searched his youthful face.
Execution on the spot, is it?
Nothing so straightforward. She continued to appraise him openly and defiantly. There's hardly a part of me that hasn't been replaced, boy. But take my word. I'm not the last of my kind, and your convoys will continue to suffer. He allowed a nod.
Only if we fail to discourage your followers.
Outland had Ka'ana and her crew transferred to one of the stolen containers, whose sublight engines were programmed to send the ship slowly but inexorably toward the system's sun. The plight of the captives was broadcast over the pirate's own communications network, and several of Ka'ana's cohorts succeeded in determining the point of origin of the transmission and hastening to her rescue. Their ships were destroyed on sight by Outland forces. The rest were wise enough to go into hiding. Wilhuff demanded that the container ship's audio and video feeds be kept enabled to the very end, so that Outland's forces and any others who might have been listening could either savor or lament the agonized wails of the pirates as they were slowly roasted to death. In the end, even the notorious Ka'ana succumbed to the torture and wailed openly.
Your task is to teach them the meaning of law and order, Jerva would hector his nephew. Then to punish them so that they remember the lesson. In the end, you'll have driven the fear of you so deeply into them that fear alone will have them cowering at your feet.
Chapter 6 Imperial Center. Brightside Coruscant Air Traffic Control directed the Carrion Spike to the Imperial Palace, and there into a courtyard landing field that was large enough to accommodate Victory and Venator-class Star Destroyers. As repulsors eased the ship down through the busy skyways and into the court, Tarkin realized that the Emperor's current residence had once been the headquarters for the Jedi, though practically all that remained of the Order's elegant temple complex was its copse of 5 skyscraping spires, now the pinnacle of a sprawling amalgam of blockish edifices with sloping facades. At the end of the landing courtyard, centered among a detail of red-robed Imperial guards armed with gleaming force pikes, stood Mos Amida, dressed in voluminous shoulder-padded robes, and carrying a staff that was taller than him, its head ornamented by a lustrous humaniform figure.
"How charitable of you to make time for us, Governor," the Shagrian said as Tarkin approached from the Corvette's lowered boarding ramp.
Tarkin played along.
"And for you to welcome me personally, Vizier."
"We all do our part for the Empire."
With crisp turns, Amida and the face-shielded guards led him through elaborate doors into the palace. Tarkin was familiar with the interior, but the expansive, soaring corridors he walked years earlier had contained a rare solemnity. Now they teemed with civilians and functionaries of many species, and the walls and plinths were left unadorned by art or statuary. Tarkin felt curiously out of step, perhaps because of the increased gravity, the pace, the crowds, or a combination of all those things. For 3 years, the only non- or near-humans he had seen or had direct contact with had been slaves or recruited laborers at outlying bases or at the battle station's construction site.
He had heard that one needn't have been absent from Coruscant for years to be startled by the changes, in that each day saw buildings raised, demolished, incorporated into ever larger and taller monstrosities, or merely stripped of Republic-era ornamentation and renovated in accordance with a more severe aesthetic. Curved lines were yielding to harsh angles, sophistication to declaration. Fashions had changed along similar lines, with few outside the imperial court affecting cloaks, headcloths, or garish robes. By most accounts, though, Coruscanti was satisfied, especially those who lived and worked in the upper tiers of the fathomless cityscape, contented for no other reason than to have the brutal war behind them. Tarkin's most carefree years had been spent on Coruscant and neighboring core worlds, before he had been elected governor of Iriadu, with some help from family members and influential contacts. He had a sudden desire to sneak outside the palace and explore the precincts he had roamed as an adventurous young adult. But perhaps it was enough to know that law and order had finally triumphed over corruption and indulgence, which had been the hallmarks of the Republic. Someone called his name as he and Amida were moving down a colonnaded walkway, and Tarkin turned, recognizing the face of a man he had known since his academy years. "Niels Tennant," he said, in genuine surprise, separating himself from the Shagrian's retinue to shake Tennant's proffered hand. Fair-skinned, with a prominent nose and a down-turning, full-lipped mouth, Tennant had commanded a Star Destroyer during the Clone Wars, and displayed on his uniform tunic the rank insignia plaque of a Rear Admiral.
"Wonderful to see you, Wilhuff," Tennant said, pumping Tarkin's hand. "I came as soon as I learned you were coming."
Tarkin affected a frown. "And here I thought my arrival would be a well-kept secret." Tennant sniffed in faint amusement.
"Only some secrets are well-kept on Coruscant." Clearly bothered by the delay, Mos Amida tapped the base of his staff on the polished floor and waited until the two had joined the retinue before moving deeper into the palace.
"Is that the new uniform?"
Tennant asked as they walked. Tarkin pinched the sleeve of the tunic.
"What, this old thing?"
Then asked before Tennant could respond,
"So who let it be known that I was coming? Was it Yularen? Tag? Motti?"
Tennant was dismissive.
"You know, you hear things."
He moved with purposeful slowness.
"You've been in the western reaches, Wilhuff?"
Tarkin nodded.
"Still hunting down General Grievous's former allies. And you?"
"Pacification,"
Tennant said in a distracted way.
"Brought back to attend the Joint Chiefs meeting."
Abruptly, he clamped his hand on Tarkin's upper arm, bringing him to a halt and encouraging him to fall back from Amida and the guards. When they seemed to be out of earshot of Amida, Tennant said,
"Wilhuff, are the rumors true?"
Tarkin adopted a questioning look.
"What rumors? And why are you whispering?"
Tennant glanced around before answering.
"About a mobile battle station, a weapon that will..."
Tarkin stopped him before he could say more, glancing at Amida in the hope that he and Tennant were in fact out of the Shagrian's range.
"This is hardly the place for discussions of that sort," he said firmly.
Tennant looked chastised.
"Of course. It's just that you hear so many rumors. People are here one day, gone the next, and no one has laid eyes on the Emperor in months. Amida, Dangor, and the rest of the ruling council have taken to dispatching processions of Imperial Sky Limos simply to maintain an illusion that the Emperor moves about in public."
He fell briefly silent.
"You know they commissioned an enormous statue of the Emperor for Senate. I mean, Imperial Plaza. So far, though, the thing looks more terrifying than majestic."
Tarkin raised an eyebrow.
"Isn't that the idea, Niels?"
Tennant nodded in a distracted way.
"You're right, of course."
Again, he regarded the nearby columns with wariness.
"The scuttlebutt is that you're scheduled to meet with him."
Tarkin shrugged noncommittally.
"If that's his pleasure."
Tennant compressed his lips.
"Put in a word for me, Wilhuff, for old time's sake. A great change is coming. Everyone senses it. And I want to be back in the action."
It struck Tarkin as an odd request, even a trifle audacious,
but in considering it, he supposed he could understand wanting to be in the Emperor's good graces, as he was certainly grateful to be there. He clapped his fellow officer on the shoulder. "If the occasion arises, Niels." Tennant smiled weakly.
"You're a good man, Wilhuff,"
he said, falling back and vanishing as Tarkin hurried to catch up with the Meader and the retinue turned a corner in the hallway. Tarkin attracted a good deal of attention as the group climbed a broad stairway and debouched into a vast atrium. Figures of all stripe and station, officials, advisers, soldiers, stopped in their tracks, even